Parshas Vayeshev, Tavshin Samaches. We will be focusing today on the two life stories, the stories of Yehuda and Yosef when they are young, and the impression they make upon their families, the role they play within their families. And clearly in this Parsha, the two main characters are Yehuda and Yosef. And everything that the Torah chooses to tell us about them is critical, because they and their destiny, okay, for us, travels through history, remains with us through history until the end, when we will finally reach the goal that we are working towards, the time of Mashiach. And the time of Mashiach will come to us in two parts. First, the era of Mashiach ben Yosef, and then the era of Mashiach ben Yehuda, which would be the descendants of David HaMelech. And so Yosef and Yehuda not just are leaders in their day, but they remain our leaders, and they, as we said, stay with us until they produce for us our ultimate leaders of Mashiach, their descendants. So our job today is to look carefully at what the Torah chooses to tell us about each one, but what is contained in this Parsha, unlike the next Parshios, is not the story of their greatness, but the story of, for both of them, their weakest moments, their most, their deepest failures, the time of hopelessness for both of them, and their dark moments. And in this Parsha are the seeds of their revival, both of them, their beginning, their ability to move, to pull themselves up from their lowest moments, and to eventually begin the path to their great moments, their crowning achievements. So what we intend to do is investigate both of them. But the Torah kind of foreshadows for us the greatness in store in a roundabout kind of way, the greatness in store for the Jewish people through Yosef and Yehuda. The first words of the Parsha are Vayeshev Yaakov Be'eretz Megurei Aviv. He went and settled finally in the place where his ancestors had lived. And we all know the famous Chazal on these words, Vayeshev, because Vayeshev means he settled, he had some Menuchas HaNefesh, he could relax a little bit. He had so many challenges in his life. He had to contend with his brother who wanted to kill him, with Lavan and with Esav. Finally, he can settle down, and the Chazal tell us here, Bikesh Yaakov Leshevet B'Shalva, he wanted to sit in peace. But what happened? The whole story with Yosef. He wasn't, and of course we forgot to mention the Dina incident, he wasn't given any downtime. Now, Chazal say, there's no Shalva, there's no peace for Tzadikim in this world. It's reserved for the next world. And why should that be? Why should they never have a moment of Menucha? So my grandfather Rav Schwab explains that peace here, that what Yaakov was seeking, is very specific. He had done his job like his parents before him. Avram had started showing the way for his descendants of what would be their mission in this world. The first thing Avram did when he came to Canaan is he built a Mizbeach. He stopped in Shechem, built a Mizbeach, and the Pasuk tells us in Perek Yud Beis, Vayikra B'Shem Hashem, he called out in the name of Hashem, which means he began to teach about the one God, to change the world through ideas. And so did Yitzchak follow in that path. He built Mizbachot and called out in the name of Hashem. And we just learned how Yaakov did too. He built a Mizbeach in Shechem and named it, right, for HaKadosh Baruch Hu had saved him. And then he built a Mizbeach in Betel and he named it. And he made it clear. And when we learn about the Avos building Mizbachot and naming them, that is the continuing their mission of being Korei B'Shem Hashem, setting up a central point where people can come and learn about Hashem. But now he felt that the time had come for him to no longer be involved in being calling out in the name of Hashem, which means in a sense outreach, teaching the world, but to focus on raising the 12 Shvatim. To focus on raising the Shivtei Kot, building Klal Yisrael. The Shalva that he was seeking was peace from that job. Chazal tell us There's no Shalva. He not only did he not, was he not relieved of the responsibility to be Korei B'Shem Hashem, through the story with Yosef, there would be the greatest opportunity of Kiddush Hashem, of being Korei B'Shem Hashem, that more than Yaakov had ever imagined. Through Yosef's descent into Egypt and the impression he made on the people there, the impact, what he did for them, he would start the ball rolling, which would end up in Yetzias Mitzrayim, and that would be fulfillment of the destiny of being Korei B'Shem Hashem of the highest order. So that job would never end for the children of Yaakov, and it would continue through Yosef. It would also continue through Yehuda being eventually the leader of the Jewish people, where Yosef became the leader of the non-Jewish world. But both of their roles as leaders did not come upon them naturally, and did not come upon them easily. We know that first the family seems to be in danger of being completely torn apart, the story of Yosef. Now, let's be clear here. Yosef was clearly an exceptional child. When Yaakov singled him out and taught him the Torah that he had learned at Shem Ve'Aver before he went to Lavan, that's what Chazal tell us. He learned specially with Yosef. When he sent the other brothers off to shepherd the sheep, he didn't send Yosef. Yosef was his chavrusa, and he would learn with him, but he specifically taught him the Torah he learned at Shem Ve'Aver. He also gave him the robe. Now, we don't know if it means striped or multicolored or trimmed, but somehow it was something that was clearly reminiscent of royalty, of sovereignty, the way the kings used to wear their coats. He certainly treated Yosef with this kind of clear understanding that Yosef was destined for leadership. He was Rachel's child, and Yaakov understood that this child had within him the ability to rise up and be a leader in the family. Now Yosef knew it too, and he was a little bit too impatient, Chazal tell us. He would do his hair because a king has to be careful with his appearance. And of course, he even was foretold that he would take on some leadership role in the family through his dreams, which he told his brothers. So the fact that Yosef was destined for leadership is obvious. And at the same time, Yehuda had become de facto the leader of the family, because Reuven still had some law. The law of Bechor still applied to him technically, but the brothers no longer respected him as Bechor because he had interfered with his father's choice of where to put make his residence, basically, after Rachel died. His father had become angry at him, and he had kind of been demoted. Shimon and Levi were not in his father's good graces at the moment because of what they had done in Shechem, and the father did not agree to that tact. And so Yehuda became the leader, and actually it was Yehuda who was considered most guilty for devising this plan about eliminating Yosef. Now Yehuda being the leader and Yosef thinking he was the leader created conflict. And without getting into the whole story, this is not our objective today. Chazal go into a tremendous amount of discussion about where the brothers got their justification to eliminate Yosef, and they really felt they were doing simply what Rivka had to do to Yitzchak. They felt that Yosef was usurping the role of leader, but more than that, that he would be convincing Yaakov that as Yitzchak passed on the legacy of the Jewish people only to one child and banish the other, perhaps Yosef was encouraging Yaakov to give him the entire future of Judaism and ignore the others, that they would not be part of Klal Yisrael, only he would follow. And they felt that their entire inheritance as Klal Yisrael, spiritual inheritance, was in danger. They were all worthy of being Klal Yisrael, not just one. And that he would be putting himself in position of like the fourth of the Avos. Now, they were on to something. There's no question about it, and we'll see later, that in a certain way he was the fourth of the Avos. No question about it. He played a role that was more like an Av than like one of the Shvatim. And in fact, the simple proof that he was more like an Av than one of the Shvatim was the fact that he didn't get a Nachala, but his two children did. And there's a lot more to it. But they were onto something, and they hated him. And we know jealousy most of the time precedes hatred. And they felt that, and they were jealous of him legitimately and righteously. In whatever case, they decided to eliminate him. What is important for us today is that Yehuda is the guilty one, the one who in the end makes the decision to get rid of him. Now, once they sell Yosef, Yehuda and Yosef both enter into the darkest times of their lives. A dark, long tunnel, and it takes a tremendous amount of fortitude for them to emerge from this tunnel and begin again and live again in the light. Look at Perek Lamed Ches, the beginning of Lamed Ches, 38, and then also switch to the beginning, flip to the beginning of Lamed Ches, 39. I just want you to see the comparison here. Vayihi be'esahi, and it was at that time, Vayered Yehuda me'et Echav, he went down from among his brothers. He was demoted. Many difficult things began to happen for him. Many things that led him into a state that would encourage him to give up on himself. If you look at Lamed Ches, the Perek starts out in a very similar way. Vayosef hurad Mitzrayimah, and Yosef was taken down to Mitzrayim. Both of them go into a Yerida. Now, Vayihi be'esahi always foreshadows for us something, always implies for us and foreshadows negative, some type of sad or negative or tragic occurrences. And here, everything for Yehuda begins to unravel. Number one, his brothers have demoted him. He is not held in respect. In fact, he abandons the family. Yaakov doesn't lose one child. Yaakov loses two children, Yosef and Yehuda, who's banished. And Yehuda goes and he attaches himself to an Adulami, whose name is Chira. And look at the next pasuk, Vayarsham Yehuda Bas Ish Kanani. A Kanani. There was a huge taboo against Kananim. Now Rashi says it don't take Kanani literally, it means a merchant. However, Targum Yonasan, for example, not everybody agree, and they say she might have been a Kanani, and he was Megayer her, she was Megayer. In any case, to marry, the fact that the Torah makes a mention of a Kanani implies that Yehuda had sees himself perhaps as not worthy of being among the Jews and marries into the nation, according to many, that was out of the Mechutz L'Machaneh. Not only that, Shua gives birth, and Shua dies, his wife dies. Then you know he has two children, Er and Onan, and they die. And not only do they die because in an act of Mesiras Nefesh, perhaps, they die because they are bad in the eyes of God. That is a tragedy. God hates them, okay? Or God is angry at them, takes away their life. Now look at Yehuda, the one who told the brothers to sell Yosef, who left their father Yaakov bereft of his wife Rachel and his son Yosef and his son Yehuda now, is also bereft of his wife and his two children. And this leads him into a state that seems to be of dejection, where he could become guilty of doing something that otherwise would have been inconceivable. And that is, of course, the incident with Tamar. Now, Tamar, we know, follows, she herself she is not in the same, you know, she's not experiencing what Yehuda's experiencing. She has her own path, and she, like Leah, like Rivka, like Rus, okay, Rivka, in a sense, using subterfuge to get what she needed from Yitzchak, but like Leah and like Rus, and you'll see like Ashes Potiphar, all of these women have to ensure that they form a union with the person that they know will be the father, the ancestor of great lineage. She knows that her first husband has died, her second husband has died. Yehuda is not giving her to the third son. According to Yibam, he gave her to the second son, but the second son died, and she was waiting for the third son. Yehuda was afraid. He didn't know in the beginning why his children died. He thought perhaps it was her fault. She was what Halacha calls a katlan, is someone who causes her husbands to die. And if a woman has two husbands who both die, then in some unusual circumstances, people might be nervous to give them a third, which is what Yehuda which what Yehuda was involved with and what he was concerned about. But she knew it wasn't her fault. She was a righteous woman. She was not from the family of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but she was from Shem, a descendant of Shem. And she knew, seemingly, Ruach HaKodesh, that she had to be married to Yehuda. And not only married to Yehuda, she was brought into this family. She had no children yet. And designed and designated that she would have children from this family. So she goes and dresses herself up as, you know, the story is a Zona. And Yehuda, at this time, being without wife, without children, far from his family, falls. Now the Torah tells us Hashem sent a malach, which means a urge, a natural impulse that operates within a person, are called malachim, an overwhelming urge for her, and he goes and sins. Well, it wasn't in the end a sin, but for him it was something we can imagine he would have never done in normal circumstances. And interestingly enough, she puts herself in a position where she, like Leah, is with someone who doesn't know who she is, but does it lishma, for the sake of God. Now, Yehuda then gives her the signet ring, the mantle, and the staff, which, by the way, Chazal tell us, are indications of the future generations that would come from this union. The signet ring implies malchus, which would come from this, David HaMelech. Shoftim, judges, leaders, which are implied by the cloak, which the judges wore, which would come from this. And Mashiach, the staff, which would come from this. Because of her acting lishma. And then, of course, you know the story. She is pregnant. Now, Yehuda, the pasuk tells us, Vayihi kimishalosh chadashim, it's 3 months that she's pregnant. No longer is she able to hide the pregnancy. Vayugad liYehuda lemor. Now she lived in Yehuda's house. She was the daughter-in-law waiting supposedly for the third son, who was still young. So it's told to Yehuda that Tamar has obviously been adulterous, and she is pregnant. Yehuda says, Hotziyuha v'tisarev. Take her out and let her be burned. By the way, not everyone agrees that this means burning totally, because that wasn't the halacha for the B'nai Noach. The Bala Turim explains it means branded, because when the Torah says tisarev ba'esh, it means burned in fire. And tisarev was an ancient custom, you know, the scarlet letter, they were branded on their foreheads. So, you know the story, and she doesn't say anything, but she sends the cloak, the staff, and the signet ring, and she says in Pasuk Chaf Hei, Hakerna, recognize please who these belong to. That word Hakerna, where have we seen it? There's two words, Hakerna, recognize. When Yehuda, because of Yehuda's advice, they kill the little animal and dip the coat in it and bring the coat back to Yaakov, and they say to Yaakov, Hakerna, recognize, whose coat is this? Please. Comes back to haunt him. He understands that this could have never happened had the ball not started rolling because of him way back then. And it came now in its full force to destroy him practically, what he had done. Hakerna recognized who do these belong to. Now here, Pasuk Chavav, this Pasuk is the Pasuk where everything turns around for Yehuda. Vayaker Yehuda, Vayomer, Yehuda recognized all of this and he says, Tzadka, Mimeni. Now, there are two ways to read this. She is more righteous than I, or she is righteous now, and the child is from me, the children. But there's a problem with that. He knows that he slept with this woman, who now he understands was Tamar, but he's not necessarily sure that the child is his, is he? Maybe she slept with more than one person. But when he said tzadka, says the malach or the ruach hakodesh, understood that this was the only time she acted inappropriately, lishma, because he withheld from her shela, the child, the third son, and therefore she was righteous, and therefore it's not like she acts like this all the time, and therefore it must be only from me. It's mimeni. Now, this must have been a moment of tremendous embarrassment for Yehuda. It was clear to everybody how low he had sunk, all the things he had done. It was clear that Hashem had punished him practically, losing everything. And yet at this time, facing a total failure, total humiliation in the eyes of others, this is where he finds it within himself to be honest, not only to be honest, to be Moda, which is the source of his name, Yehuda, to admit the truth, but the main critical key here, which sends him now beginning on the path to kingship, to sovereignty, to leadership, is the one word, achrayus, responsibility. He takes responsibility. And the essential character of the king is that the king must be someone who takes responsibility for the people. We don't have kings who plunder from the people. We have kings who take responsibility for the people. Here is the indication of the achrayus, the responsibility Yehuda takes for the truth, for what he did, for the children that will be born, for his daughter-in-law. And of course, there are two children, Peretz, who is the great-grandfather of David HaMelech, and Zarach. Now, I want you to keep in mind the concept of the 3 months that she was hiding her pregnancy, because we will come back to it a little later. This is the story of Yehuda's fall and his beginning, the beginning of his rising up again. Now, let's compare this to Yosef. Next perek. Yosef, Hurad Mitzrayma, he was taken down to Mitzrayim. Actually, I want to add one more thing here. This achrayus that Yehuda displayed here now becomes his nature, his character. He understands that's his responsibility. And it's in full force later on when in Perek Mem Gimel Pasuk Tes, where although he did not take responsibility for Yosef, he understood that is his role to be the one who does take responsibility. And in Perek Mem Gimel Pasuk Tes, he is the one that convinces Yaakov to send down Binyamin with him. And he says, regarding his responsibility to Binyamin, Anochi Ervenu, I will take responsibility for him. Now we know, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazeh, that's the same Shoresh. All Jews are responsible for one another. This begins with, really not so much Yehuda, by the way, who sets the stage for this? Who really demonstrates this prior to Yehuda? That all Jews are responsible for each other. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazeh. Hmm? Before Yehuda. It's really, first of all, it's Rachel and Leah. When Rachel gave the simanim to Leah, she was clearly behaving according to the awareness that she had, that Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazeh, that she had to take achrayus for Leah, and she couldn't leave Leah to her fate. And therefore, Yehuda was born simply because of the arvus that Rachel had for Leah. And this became clear to him that this was his task. This would be his defining trait. And he says to Yaakov, Anochi Ervenu, I will take responsibility for him. Miyadi Tevakshenu, you can look for him and you can ask for him from my hands. This arvus between Yehuda and Binyamin existed in Klal Yisrael throughout all the ages, and in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Yud Ches, this, hundreds of years later, this arvus is called again into play when Goliath is threatening Shaul, who's from Binyamin, and David's brothers are at the battlefield. The father says, go see how your brothers are doing. But it wasn't just a social visit to bring them a little food and see how they're doing. Yishai tells David, go there, take a certain amount of food, some bread, and this and that. And then he said, V'esachicha tifkod l'shalom, see how your brothers are doing if they're in peace. And Yishai tells David, V'et aruvatam tikach, and take their aruva. And then the Chazal discuss, what is aruva? Chazal say here, just like Yosef, just like Yehuda, your great-grandfather, made a promise that he would protect Binyamin. You, David HaMelech, you now can come here and take that promise that your grandfather made and put it into play, because Goliath is threatening Shaul, who is the great-grandchild of Binyamin. And you go there and you stand up and protect Binyamin, because that's the role of Yehuda, always the protector of Binyamin. Because he didn't have the opportunity to protect, or rather he fell short in protecting Yosef, so he made it his life's work through all the generations to protect Binyamin. So this was Yehuda, and in the end you know what Yehuda did in order to protect Binyamin, and that's what made Yosef reveal himself, when he saw the complete change in Yehuda's personality and Yehuda's sense of himself, how he would go, how he would give up, completely sacrifice himself entirely for Binyamin. So that's when Yosef realized they had done tshuva and the family can be whole again. That's Yehuda's path. He represents for us a leader who emerges from the lowest point in his life, from hopelessness, from a terrible sense of the, of his role among the family. He represents the Baal tshuva, the person that can raise himself up from all his mistakes, and the children of Yehuda and Tamar, according to many, have within themselves some non-Jewish blood, as does, for example, Boaz and Ruth later on, who come from, Boaz comes from Peretz, right, and Ruth comes from Moab, so that the leader, the Mashiach, who eventually comes to speak and win over the hearts of all the people in the world, will not only be a Baal Tshuva who recognizes that people can sink all the way down and still be salvageable, but also will have within them some aspect of the non-Jewish world so that they can relate to everybody. This is where the leadership of Yehuda comes from. Now Yosef has a whole different path. For Yosef hurad Mitzrayim, and Yosef was forcefully taken down to Mitzrayim against his will. And we know the story. But unlike Yehuda, who thought very little probably of himself, who was banished by the brothers, who fell into a state of probably self-loathing until he picked himself up, Yosef had a whole different path. Yosef always knew who he was and was proud of who he was and didn't hide who he was. And from the moment he arrived in Egypt, Pasuk Beis, Vayhi Hashem es Yosef. Hashem was with Yosef. Vayhi ish matzliach. He was a very successful person. And Vayar Adonav Pasugimel. His master saw ki Hashem ito. Hashem was with him. And Chazal tells us here, Rashi tells us here, how did they know Hashem was with him? Because he was with Hashem. Because he constantly referred to Hashem. Baruch Hashem, Bezrat Hashem. He constantly made references to Hashem in the house of Potiphar, in the Mitzrayim, where he was the only Jew in the entire land. So they saw Hashem was with him, and everything he did, he found Hatzlacha, Vayimtza Yosef Chein. He was beloved, he was elevated everywhere he went. He was, you know, his stature was promoted, his stature became greater and greater in the eyes of everyone who was with him. He thought well of himself. He understood, perhaps, that he was here for a reason, because he had an unnatural success in everything he touched. And just like Yehuda, in his lowest point, was attacked, so to speak, or was confronted, was put into a very compromising position with a woman who was acting lishma, Yosef, too, in a moment of strength and a moment of greatness, was also being put into a very compromising position with a woman who also believed that she was destined to bear offspring from Yosef, and she saw this in the astrology, and she wasn't so wrong, but it wasn't her, we know. It was her daughter that was married to Yosef, Asnat. Now, here's what happens. Yehuda takes off his cloak to give it to Tamar. What happens to Yosef? Pasuk Yud Beis. Vatit Peshehu Bebigdo. She grabs him from his, she grabs his cloak. And he doesn't willingly take it off and leave it with her as a form of payment. He leaves his cloak with her as he escapes her. As he escapes. And by the way, I want you to start in Pasuk Yud Beis. You can count how many times the phrase Vayozov Bigdo Biyada shows up. There's one in Yud Beis. There's one in Yud Gimel. There's one in Tesvav. There's one in Tes Zayin. And there's one in Yud Ches. Five times he leaves behind his bigodim, his clothing with her, the Torah repeats to us, and escapes. Yosef is not the story of somebody who sins and picks himself up again. Yosef is the story of a person who never sins, who doesn't fall to the sin, no matter how enticing it was. Yosef is the person that couldn't see himself sinning because he had such a strong vision of his position, the son of Yaakov, that Hashem was with him. How could he make a chilul Hashem? He even says to her, it would be a lack of gratitude to everything your husband has done for me to do this, to betray him like this. He holds himself in high regard. This is beneath him. And though the Torah tells us he was about to sin, he was just about to complete the act of adultery. He was on the verge, but he didn't sin. He was escaped. Now, that puts Yosef, Ashes Potiphar in a very uncomfortable position. Notice the difference between Tamar, who bears the seeds of Mashiach, and Ashes Potiphar, who also believed, and somewhat correctly so, that she had some future with Yosef and understood Yosef's greatness and wanted to be attached to Yosef. He was entirely different than the men she was surrounded with, and she understood this. She had a tremendous desire for him, not just physically, but also clearly intellectually and on every level. He was totally unique. He was great. But look at the difference between Ashes Potiphar and Tamar. The difference is very apparent, and my father-in-law pointed this out to me many years ago. The difference in people, and in fact the essence of their greatness, often becomes apparent not at their moments of success, but at the moments of failure. Look what happens when Tamar faces what she considers failure for her attempt to connect to Yehuda, and what Ashes Potiphar does when she senses failure or sees failure in her attempt to be connected to Yosef. Tamar sacrifices herself. She was willing to be burned or branded if he would not admit the truth. She wouldn't say a word. That's clear. She let herself go to the fire, or whatever it was. She's subjected to the humiliation of having a mark on her forehead when she was, in a sense, innocent. And Ashes Potiphar doesn't risk that. Ashes Potiphar turns the whole thing around and blames Yosef. So this is the difference. One bears Mashiach, and from one comes nothing. Now Yosef, therefore, at this moment, this causes him to be thrown into the bar, by the way, for the second time. If you look later, he talks about his innocence, Perek Mem, Pasuk Tesvav, 40:15. He introduces himself. He says, I was stolen from the... He explains who he is when he's talking to the baker and the winemaker, and he says, I was stolen from Eretz HaIvrim, and there I was innocent. Vegam po lo asiti mumon, here I'm innocent. Ki samu oti babar, and they threw me in the bar again. He sees himself innocent the first time and innocent the second time, but Chazal don't see him entirely innocent. Chazal think that he was a little bit in both cases guilty of being too ambitious, not being patient enough for his malchus to be bestowed upon him, which was inevitable. He knew he would be a melech. He was a little too impatient with his brothers. And perhaps the way he saw himself in Mitzrayim and the luck he found made him so convinced that he also perhaps was a little too impatient and he needed to be, you know, to wait. And so he sees twice he was thrown into a bar. And yet, the difference now becomes clear between Yehuda and Yosef, and their two separate paths in history. Yehuda, for us, we said, he's the Baal Tshuva. He's the one who picks himself up. But that's not Yosef's story. Yosef is the few and precious, righteous men and women, tzaddikim, that don't sin at all. We call Yosef HaTzaddik. He's the only person called Yosef HaTzaddik. It's HaTzaddik in the Tanakh. And that's because he never sinned at all. He never fell to sin. He held himself back. He is what we call tzaddik meikaro. He is a tzaddik from the essence. He didn't lapse and return like Yehuda. He is tzaddik meikaro. He represents a different kind of leader from the Jewish people, but he is really the leader of the few and the unique, the yechidim, the righteous ones who never sin at all. And he achieves leadership. And he also, his leadership, and he knows it, and he even tells his brother this, is for one person, he tells all his brothers, and one person only, is for one reason and one reason only, to take achrayus for them. Hashem sent him here and caused him to finally find his position as the second in command for one reason, to take achrayas for his brothers so that he can provide for them. He can provide for them food and a place to live in the famine when they begin the gullus. He saw that clearly as his only role, that his dreams were for them, that his leadership was on their behalf, and he was here to take care of them, and that's why he forgives them and he absolves them. He says, it wasn't you, you meant for bad, but Hashem sent me here for good, to take care of you, to support you in the famine, which we'll see at the end of Bereishis. He also takes Achrayas. But now we have two potential leaders, the Baal Tshuva and the Tzadik Tamim. Not to say that they were perfect from the day they were born, but when they finally defined themselves in who they were, and both in relationship to, you know, to with women and with this type of compromising situation, that's how both of them are tested. One becomes the Baal Tshuva, and one is the Tzadik Mikaro. Now, so we are told that we have two leaders that will eventually bring in the end of days, Mashiach ben Yehuda and Mashiach ben Yosef. Now, we know also the famous idea, Hashem tells us that the Geula will come, Be'ito Achishenu. Now, we know Be'ito means in its time, and Achishenu means, I will speed it up, before its time. So there are two possibilities. It seems to be that if Klal Yisrael are on the Madrega of Yosef, Tzadikim, who stay strong and don't sin and resist the temptations around them, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can bring Mashiach earlier. But if that Bechina of Yosef is lost, as we know, Chazal tell us, Mashiach ben Yosef will die. And Mashiach ben Yosef doesn't have to be a person. Mashiach ben David does, but Chazal seem to tell us that Mashiach ben Yosef is an era or an opportunity. If Mashiach ben Yosef dies, and Klal Yisrael is not on the Madrega of being tzaddikim, at the core, remaining pure, remaining true to our Torah and our mitzvahs, then don't become hopeless. There are always, we can rely on that there will be Mashiach ben David, who is the Baal Tshuva. That is, by the way, the secret of Kol Berama Nishma, Rachel's crying, Rachel's sobbing, and her inability to be comforted. Rachel is sobbing, Chazal tells her, Moshe Shapiro points this out, because she understands that her child, Yosef, his leadership, which is based on righteousness to the core, not sinning, but resisting sin. Vayanas, he ran away. By the way, where does that word come again? Where do we find it? Vayanas Yosef. Hayam ra'a vayanas. And Halel, what did the Yam see and run away? The bones, the coffin of Yosef that were being carried with Klal Yisrael. So Rachel is crying because the Bechina of Yosef is in danger of being lost. When did Rachel cry? After which Beis HaMikdash was destroyed? When did the Jews pass by for the first time Rachel's kever, and there it says she came out, so to speak, and cried for her children? After the first Beis HaMikdash, when they were going to Bavel, Rachel was crying. Because she understood that the Beis HaMikdash had been destroyed and the Jewish people had been intact in their land, and now they would go to Golos. And how was it possible? Her son did it. Yosef remained at Tzadik in Golos. But what's the chances that Klal Yisrael will have the Koach? And what if the whole Bechina of Yosef would be lost? That whole aspect of pure righteousness would be lost. What would there be for Klal Yisrael? So they come for Rachel. They tell Rachel, stop crying. Don't worry, Shavu Banim Ligvulam, your children will return to their borders. So he explains that they were even comforting Rachel that the Bechina of Yosef will never be entirely lost. There will always be among Klal Yisrael tzaddikim that never sin at all, or perhaps in the most critical areas, never abandon their connection to their ancestors. We know that Yosef saw Yaakov's face, and we'll go back to this in a minute, and so to speak, in his mind, and that stopped him from sinning. There will always be in Klal Yisrael those tzaddikim, and we speak about this. We talk about the Lamid Vav tzaddikim that hold up the whole generation, that are the core, because we know it's very good and well that everyone can be Baalei Tshuva, but if there's no core that remains strong, where do they come back to? To who? To what? Not everybody can lapse. and then do tshuva. Somebody has to remain holding down the fort, staying in the remaining true to Torah. Somebody to come back, somebody to show the way. So they comfort Rachel and say, what you produce, don't worry, they will, that will also continue to exist. So we have here Yehuda and we have here Yosef, and we have the understanding that both aspects of greatness exist in Klal Yisrael. What's interesting now is the connection to Hanukkah. Remember we spoke about the 3 months that she could no longer hide her pregnancy? Well, there's something interesting about our light and the way it's and how light, one of the hints, one of the ramazim surrounding R in our Torah, and it always focuses on 3 months. 3 months. Seems to be that you can't hide the R, in this case the R of Mashiach, for more than 3 months. For example, when Moshe was born, what happened to the house? The house was filled with R. How long did his mother hide him for? 3 months. By the way, what day was Moshe born? Count 3 months from Zion Adar. Zion Sivan. What's on Zion Sivan? There's Chasser Mal, you know the Machlokas, right? Matan Torah. The R comes down, the Oraisa. 3 months from Moshe's birth, Moshe then eventually is the one who brings down the R, the Oraisa on Har Sinai. When was the first R of creation? What day was the R of the first day created? What day of the month? Which month and which day? Chaf Hei Elul. What are 3 months after Chaf Hei Elul? Chaf Hei Kislev. Hanukkah. Now the 25th word in the Torah is R, by the way, but it doesn't just relate to the 25th of Elul, when R was created, but the 25th of Hanukkah. However, interesting, this has to do with Yosef. The R HaGanos that we speak about in the creation story, what kind of light was that? Is it here today? Yeah. Remember the Rashi? Hashem saw that it was good and put it away for the tzaddikim, lasid lavo. So what do we call that light? We call that light the R HaShechina. That's the light of Har Sinai. That's the light of Nevuah. That's the light of when the Shechina comes into this world and penetrates into this world. That Or HaGanuz came down to this world on Vav Sivan, that hidden light came down to this world when the Torah was given. And we had 1,000 years of Nevuah and open miracles. However, that era also came to an end. And we no longer have the light of the Or HaGanuz. We don't have the light of Nevuah anymore and open miracles. We have a different kind of light. Starting with Hanukkah, we have the light of the menorah, which illuminates for us the rest of our historical path. Now, the light of Hanukkah, the light of the menorah, is different than the light that came down on Har Sinai, the light that would fill up the Beis HaMikdash, the heavenly light. The Or of Hanukkah means something different, and it's associated with Yosef. The light of the menorah, and really we'll go back to an idea I've mentioned in the past and help explain why as long as we're in Eretz Yisrael, the minhag is, the mitzvah is, to put the menorah on the left side of the doorpost and the mezuzah on the right side of the doorpost, so that one should be surrounded by the mezuzah for 8 days a year and the menorah. The connection between the mezuzah and the menorah and the two lights and Yosef. All of this will come together, hopefully, quickly. The mezuzah represents the infancy of the Jewish people. When did we first sanctify the doorposts? In Mitzrayim. And how were they sanctified? They were sanctified with the blood of the Korban Pesach. And the blood of the Korban Pesach, contrary to what most people think, was brushed inside the house. As the Pasuk says, it'll be a os, a sign, lachem, for you in the houses that you are sitting in. So when the Jewish people slaughtered the sheep, thereby committing themselves to the concept of a single God, ruler of heavens and earth, they distinguished themselves from the Egyptians. They decided that they're separate, they're unique, They broke away from the nation they lived amongst, in which they had been very assimilated into, although persecuted by, still assimilated into. And they made a statement, and they took a stand, and they looked at that blood that they had put on their doorpost, and they knew who they were when they sat that night as Hashem fought for them outside their homes, slaughtering all the firstborns, which was a way of demonstrating to the world that there's only one firstborn that is legitimate, and that is my firstborn nation, Israel. Which, by the way, did not become known as the firstborn nation because we were the first nation to ever be created. Obviously not. The Jewish people didn't even emerge onto the scene as a people for 2,500 years after the creation. However, we took upon ourselves the role of the firstborn, the guide and the teacher of the rest of the children. That's clear. So the Jewish people sat back, and Hashem fought their battles for them, and Hashem showed the world there's one God, master of heavens and earth, creator and knower of all things, who demands certain obedience and compliance, or there will be repercussions. He made that whole arrangement very clear. That's the mezuzah. And for 1,000 years, the R of the Nevuah, of the open miracles, the R of the Torah shown down in the world through miracles in the Beis HaMikdash, through prophecy, we were a light to the nations. And then that was lost. And Hanukkah represents for us, it represents the last great miracle that is recorded, that is officially included as part of our yearly cycle. And it took place about 200 years before the Common Era, 1,500 years after Yetzias Mitzrayim. And things had changed a lot between Yetzias Mitzrayim and the mezuzah, and the Jewish people sitting there and waiting for God to show the world who he was, and that his words were true, and that the Jewish people were his nation. By 1,500 years later, things had changed. The Jewish people were threatened again with total assimilation, and with the demand was made that they negate all the differences between them and the other people, the Greeks. Now, did the Jewish people lock themselves in their homes as they did on Pesach and say, God, fight for us? God, do something? There was not a time of open miracles. It was not the time of hailstones and sea splitting and things like that. The Jewish people, led by Matatzeo, as you know, took up arms and fought the battle and took casualties and were Moser Nefesh. Now, what does that mean? It means the Jewish people were not babies, who HaKadosh Baruch Hu any longer in their infancy, where Hashem had to do everything for them and teach the world the truth. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was, in a sense, quiet, Shti Hoda'ah. Here Hashem was quiet, Shtika Kehoda'ah, and allowed the Jewish people to stand up and fight for the truth that they now knew so well and had been so ingrained in them for 1,500 years. And the Jewish people did, and they succeeded. And Hashem didn't speak to them in Hanukkah. There's no more Nevuah. It is the era where there are no more open miracles. But Hanukkah tells us that when they did succeed, when they did lead, they did fight for the truth, not because a Navi led them, but because the Chachamim led them, the sages led them, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did a miracle for them. Now let people get confused about this. The Nes on the menorah, it was a time of no more Nes Galoy, except for one. The Nes of the fire burning was a Nes Galoy, an open miracle, but it happened in secret, where only a few people could see. Eventually we took this Nes and put it in all of our homes. But when it first took place, it was a Nes Galoy, it besaser, secretly. But the concept of the menorah, therefore, would be forever. That in an era where there is no Nevuah, where there is no open miracles, where God doesn't break open the heavens and teach the truth to the world, it becomes the responsibility of the Jewish leader, of the Chacham, of the Chachamim, to lead the way and to fight for what's true. So we move from an era, Hanukkah begins, that lights our way for the rest of the Galus till the end, till Mashiach. And it tells us that now the light of the menorah, the light not of prophecy has to lead us, but the light of Chochmah. Now think about Yosef. And think about Mashiach. All the various lights. The Ar HaGonos of the beginning of the world, the Ar HaShchina, when does it emerge 3 months later? The Ar of Hanukkah. Which means to say it's the same light. The light that began the creation of the world, the light of God's revelation, the light we saw for 1,000 years of prophecy and miracles, that is the same light. But it's revealed now through the Hanukkah menorah, through the leaders, through the Chachamim, through the people who pick themselves up and fight for the truth at great risk to themselves. Those are the people bringing the very same light to the world. And Yosef in Mitzrayim. Did you ever think about it? Is there ever a case in the Chumash where it says Vayidaber Hashem el Yosef or Vayomer Hashem el Yosef? No, Yosef does not really receive nevuah. Even the dreams were not real nevuah. We know that Hashem puts thoughts into people's heads while they dream, which have some truth to them. Yosef was not a Navi. And in Mitzrayim they say to him, "He ain't. There's no one chacham v'navon. There's no one as smart and understanding as you. He is a chacham. He represents for us the light of the menorah." From Yosef's era on, okay, for the Jewish people in Mitzrayim, there is no nevuah anymore. There are no open miracles till the end. There is only the chachma, the leadership that guides them. So when we read about Yosef and his role in Mitzrayim, we're also reading about, as we know from last week, we trace the Masa of Asim and Labanim. Remember what we said. Dina was compared to Yavon for many reasons. After they vanquished the Greeks, they went up and rededicated the Mizbeach, just like Yaakov went to Beit Kel and rededicated the Mizbeach, right? That was the second, that was after the Greeks, the renewal of the second Beis HaMikdash, the rededication. Then they wanted a little peace. They wanted to have them. It was the first time, by the way, in Jewish history, in the Second Temple era, rather, that they were actually ruled by their own kings, not the Persians and the and Philip of Macedonia and Alexander the Greek and the Ptolemies and the Seleucid and all the various empires that ruled them. It was the first time they had their own rulership. They wanted a few years of peace before they turned around. The empire of the Hashmonaim had unfortunately deteriorated into Sinas Chinam, Horkinus, Aristobulus, the Sinas Chinam of Yosef, Yosef to Gullus, us into our long Gullus. So the Gullus of Mitzrayim foretells for us our long, this current long Gullus we're in. And Yosef in Mitzrayim represents the R of the menorah, the R of the Chachamim, the R of the same R that will guide us and lead us till the end. But in the end, we will have the R of Mashiach, that she couldn't hide either for more than 3 months, and comes the light of Mashiach. But Yosef, what we're learning here is, through the course of Jewish history, to ensure that there will be a nation at the end who can do teshuva, the Bechina of Yehuda, there must be a Yosef along the way, and a few people who are like Yosef, who hold the course all along the way, and represent for us the leaders, the people, the Asara Haruge Malchus, the people that would die for their truth, for their belief, and all the great leaders of that ilk, that of that style through the course of history, which we all have had, and we all know about. And my father, when he lived in Baltimore, was a young boy when my grandfather came from Germany. And everybody knows the famous story of Rav Elchanan Wasserman, who came to America to try to raise funds and help his yeshiva in Baranovich. And the war, you know, was the Hitler days, and things were getting terrible. It was in 1933, I think, and Rav Elchanan Wasserman came to America, and everybody knows the story of how he insisted on returning to his yeshiva and was murdered along with all his bachurim. But that trip to America, he stayed in my grandfather's house in Baltimore, and he slept in my father's bed at the time. And that was the trip that he went back to Europe. There were always people among us, men and women, who held the course, kept and made sure there would be a Klal Yisrael. Otherwise, there's no one. The Bechina of Yehuda is lost too. But we have to know that we don't rely today on the Nisim and the Nevuos. We say, God, do us a miracle, do something big. Now is the Bechina of Yosef. And I must add one more aspect about Yosef that Rav Huttner points out so beautifully. Each of the Avos, we get back to the point that he was among the Avos in a certain way. By the way, he's one of the Yushpizin. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef. And my grandfather, Rav Huttner points this out. Avram was the first to become a Jew. He contributed, he stamped upon the world the possibility of accepting upon oneself the Kedusha, the Madrega of being among the Jewish people. Yitzchak was the first to be born a Jew, Kadosh Mibeten, sanctified from the womb. He stamped upon the world the possibility that a nation can exist from that the very moment of their birth they are already unique. Yaakov was another one of the avos. This is what we call avos, by the way, because they implanted a koach that never goes away. Yaakov was the first one to ensure mitaso shlema, that everyone who will be born a Jew, although they sin, will still be a Jew. Because realize that until Yaakov, if this wasn't the case, you could choose to be, so to speak, a Jew. You could be born into Judaism like Esav, but you can abandon it, you can lose it, you can be banished. So to guarantee the survival of the Jewish people, you need another madrega. You need the madrega that everybody born to a Jew, even if they sin, remains a Jew. They can do tshuva. Yisrael, afilu shechata, Yisrael hu. But there's one more danger. What if you have the possibility to be a Jew, to be born a Jew, to sin as a Jew and do tshuva as a Jew? So does that ensure that the Jewish people are intact? No. Because that there's always a possibility of total intermarriage and assimilation. So just leave it completely, not do tshuva. Just abandon the Jewish people and the nation entirely. So the koach of Yosef, which sustains us through history, is there's an additional koach besides the koach of chachma, of righteousness. The koach of Yosef also is the koach not to take that final step across the red line and intermarry. When Yosef was about to sin with Eshes Potiphar, had Yosef sinned, he was the only one put in this situation in a foreign land with the danger of assimilation and intermarriage. Had he weakened and failed, we would not have an Av, an ancestor, to set for us, to create a reality, to implant it in our spiritual genetics, so to speak, that we have the power to resist intermarriage and assimilation. In that way, when he resisted, he was one of the avos. He set for Klal Yisrael the feature of resistance against utter assimilation and intermarriage, which explains one last thing, which I've said many times, but it bears repeating, and with this we will end. When Yaakov, without reading the Medrash inside, the Gemara inside, right, when Yosef was about to sin, right? You're probably familiar with this. It says that he saw his father's face. And then he heard from his father, from Amalek, the following message. He said, Yosef, do you want the path? Are you willing to forego? Are you willing do you understand that you will lose your place in the Choshen? All the names of the Shvatim, I'm sorry, he says in the Ephod. Do you know that you will lose your position in the Ephod? In the Ephod, every Shevet's name is written on a stone, and your name will not be amongst them. Are you willing to forego this? Now, when Yehuda sinned, nobody warned him that his name would be wiped out from the Ephod. And when Reuven sinned, nobody said, your name is going to be wiped out from the Ephod. So my grandfather points out here a beautiful idea in his Sefer Mayan Beis HaShoeva. He says, look carefully. What Yosef heard was, your name will not be amongst your brothers in the Ephod. They didn't hear in the Choshen. The Choshen, there's one stone per tribe. But the Ephod was different. Yosef's stone in the Choshen was a shoham, an onyx. But the onyx appeared in another place in the Big Day Kahuna. On the epaulets. There were two epaulets, both of Yosef's stone, shoham. And on one was written six shvatim, and on one was written six shvatim. So what Yosef was hearing is, Yosef, la'asid, in the future, your brothers' names will be written on your stone. You hold the key to the strength of the Jewish people not to assimilate, intermarry in Golis. If you do this now, you will not be the basis. You will not be there, which means Klal Yisrael won't be there. This is your role. So Yosef provides for us these three kochos, the koach of survival, the koach of chachma, which takes us through, and the koach of pure righteousness. All of these three are the forces we need until, in the end, Mashiach ben Yehuda arises and brings the rest of Klal Yisrael back in tshuva. But as we see, without the kochos of Yosef, somehow, some way intact in some people, we're lost. So we all play the role, a little bit of Yosef and a little bit of Yehuda. When we go to Kevar Rachel, we have to also daven not just that we have the strength to Kevar Rachel. You know, what we're really reassuring Rachel is, we could be not only like the Bnei Yosef, like the Bnei Yehuda, but we also have ability to be like the Bnei Yosef. We have to see that in ourselves also. Okay, everybody. Have a wonderful week.